All right, Larry. Thank you, first of all, for taking the time. And I won't talk about Districted because you haven't seen it, but can you just give me the theory about Districted? What's the, I mean, to do a take on porn, what does that mean? What are they trying to do different? What are they trying
to do?
They're
just having artists who you have to ask them. The way I thought it was they asked a bunch of artists for their take on porn. They could do anything they wanted to do. And people have done all different things. I haven't seen the other six. I haven't seen them, so I don't know.
Most people that I, in my circles, all my life really, pretty much everybody I know finds the thing that's wrong with porn is not the idea of arousal. The thing that's wrong with porn is the tediousness of it, the boredom, lack of talent, the people involved, which is why I'm always intrigued when guys like yourself and, you know, people that are up to something other than just being exploitation people do it.
So. Yeah, well, mine's an educational film. It's social comment. You'll see. It got very involved because I was curious about the effect on people today. So, but anyway, you'll see it.
Okay. All right.
Another time. The rockers we're going to talk about.
Right. The
which you've seen.
I saw in Toronto.
In Toronto, right? Of course, right. We talked about that.
And it's kind of reminds you of right away of. Kind of made me think of the Warriors, about a group going into foreign territory, and was there some mythical inspiration? Were you thinking about Ulysses? Were you thinking about something classical when you came up with this idea?
Well, I met these kids and I thought it would be great to make a documentary about their lives in South Central. You know, how they have to fight to be themselves and the peer pressure to conform. Seems to be greater there than anywhere else because, but I don't do documentaries, so I said, well, I'll do a film, and I'll start the film looking kind of like a documentary of their lives in South Central, and then I'll take them on some adventure. So I just made it up. I actually was sitting at lunch one day by myself and just started thinking about it, and I said, well, it was interesting because Paris Hilton and Nikki Hilton were in the news all the time then. This was way before the Paris Hilton porn tape. This was when they were in the news every day and on TV every day just for going to clubs, for doing nothing but going to clubs and had their last name being Hilton. And so I said, well, what if Paris and Nikki, what if these kids got up one Saturday morning, drove into Hollywood and went to Beverly Hills High to skate this famous skate spot there, the Nine Stairs, and Paris and Nikki drove by and picked him up and were fascinated by these Latino boys and picked him up and took him up into Beverly Hills, and their boyfriends came, and they got in a fight and they started running, and they jumped a fence to get away because the cops were coming, and then who would they meet as they went into this backyard? And then I just started going with it. Well, they could meet, and I started thinking about, well, who would live in Beverly Hills, and kind of goofing on that. And so when I wrote it, of course, it wasn't Paris and Nikki Hilton in the film, but I got the idea just because they were in the news, and I just started having fun, and I thought about The Warriors. I thought about, what are some of my favorite movies? I said, well, The Warriors. I said, what if they get stuck there, stuck in Beverly Hills, and somehow have to escape to the safety of South Central? And everybody knows South Central is not safe, but it's safer for them than Beverly Hills is. And I just started having fun and writing, and that's kind of how it happened. It was this kind of stream of consciousness. And it was interesting also that after I'd written it, like months later, I remembered that one of my favorite films of all time was The Swimmer. And in The Swimmer, which is based on a John Cheever novel, Burt Lancaster is going to swim across Beverly Hills pool by pool. So he goes in backyards and meets people and has conversations. So that was in my subconscious also. And it just kind of got out of hand. I just, mixing genres and action adventure Hollywood kind of thing with this, with these kids, and starting out looking like a documentary. It was just, it was fun because this is the first film that I've written by myself, and so you can kind of see that because the structure's all over the place. I mean, it's certainly not any kind of classical structure at all.
Do you anticipate, whenever I see a film that's about, Latino culture, I always wonder, the ones that I like for instance, the one that I love so much, Girl Fight.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
2000, was that?
Yeah,
five years ago, right. 6 years? Karen Kusama. So now this is really something that I really loved a lot, and yet the Latina culture didn't really go for it that much. I mean, they kind of, I guess, I don't know what the business was, but it wasn't that much. It was all right, but it wasn't, I always wonder, what is it that, do you anticipate that people, of that age group are going to get into this movie? Because I would, if I were, in that culture, I would probably definitely want to see this thing, because it's about me, it's about my friends, mm-hmm. it's about mm-hmm. the,
Well, you're getting at really the reason why I really wanted to make the film. The basic reason was you never get to see these kids. You don't see these kids in film. They're never represented. If you do see these kids in film, they're gangbangers or drug addicts or something, not good kids. And these are good kids. And I met these kids and I saw that these kids just have fun, they're not, smoking pot, they're not drinking beer, they're just having fun, and this exuberance of life and living for the moment, which is what kids do anyway, they live for the moment, but these kids really live for the moment because they live in a very dangerous environment, and they're really trying to live their life to the fullest under very difficult situations, where they might get shot and killed walking to school 2 blocks away, which happened recently, when right after we wrapped the film, I was watching TV, and Locke High School comes up, this shot of Locke High School, which was just like my shot in my film. And I said, that's from my movie. How'd they get that shot? And it turned out that there'd been a shooting there, and it was the news, and there'd been a drive-by after school, like 3:15, when all the kids were standing out in front of school, hundreds of kids, some idiot drove by, some gangbanger drove by to try and shoot somebody and missed. They always miss and hit a 15-year-old girl in the neck, an innocent little 15-year-old high school girl, and killed her. And that's the kind of shit that happens, and these kids just, live with all the time. So anyway, they're good kids and interesting kids, and people who have seen the film have told me that, they say it's really nice that we get to see these kids, it's really good that you did this, and I think the film will do very well in the Latino community, and I think they'll be glad I made the film, hopefully.
Is WhatsApp Rockers going to Slam Dance with the intention, I presume? I don't even know if you have. I'm sorry to have not done my homework, mm-hmm. but do you have a distributor?
Yes, we do. First Look.
Sorry.
First Look will distribute the film.
All right.
Henry Winterstern produced the film and paid for the film. He gave me the money for the film. He's a wonderful guy. Great producer. And then he bought First Look. So we're going to distribute it to the guy. I mean, what could be better for a filmmaker? A guy gives you finances the film, and then buys a company so we can distribute the film. So,
The purchase of First Look that we're speaking of happened how long ago?
Just recently, but after we'd wrapped the film. I think First Look's been around 25 years.
Right.
And so I know now Henry's the new guy, the new boss.
Just that a friend of mine from Paramount Classics, Ruth Vitale.
Oh, Ruth is great. Yeah, Ruth Vitale. She's just come on board a couple of weeks ago, a few weeks ago, and I like her a lot. And she's really smart and knows what she's doing.
Right.
So I'm really happy to be working with Ruth. I just saw her yesterday. Oh, no, Friday I saw her.
When she was at Paramount Classics, she would make kind of a routine of having a few journalists up and some friends over to her place on Solomir up in Deer Valley.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's, she's one of the warmest people.
Yeah. I like her a lot.
Yeah. So how is it, did you come to write this alone? You say this is a departure for you. Again, I'm obviously I'm going to have to edit this out, but mm-hmm. I'm confessing to not knowing about your writing partner. So if you could help me on that and just take me through that.
Well, the other films, like Kids was all my story. I had this story. I had a treatment about what happened, and then I met Harmony, as you mentioned earlier, and Harmony was one of the kids in the group. And knew the way they talked, because he talked that way. And so I told him the story and asked him to write it, because I knew it had to be written from the inside. Because I'd been hanging out with those kids for a long years, a couple of years, and really got to know them, and they accepted me and let me into this secret world. And I couldn't bring a writer in, So anyway, so I met Harmony, and he wrote the dialogue and wrote a brilliant script. And then Ken Park was written right after Kids at the same time. Ken Park, I had all these stories and characters, and probably it was like three different movies, but I wanted to put them all in one movie. So I said, Harmony, I have all these characters, and here's what happens to them in the stories, and can we somehow structure this into one film? And then he wrote this brilliant little screenplay for me, Ken Park. And Bully is based on an investigative crime reporter's book, Jim Schutz, who wrote this book, Bully, and I shot it straight from the book. So it's all what he wrote in the book. The dialogue is straight from the book. I've always worked with a writer. But this one I was on my own, and I just dreamed it up, and it was actually like a 50-page script, because there were I knew what I wanted the kids to do a lot, so there'd be scenes in the script that just says Kiko and Nikki sit on the bed and talk, and that was all it said. Now the scene in the movie is 8 minutes long. But I knew what I wanted Kiko to talk about. I wanted him to talk about his life, and I knew basically the details and what he may say. But I didn't want to write it down. I just wanted to put him in the situation where he was talking to this girl and she was asking him questions, and it was very magical. So it's an improv,
a structured improv.
A structured improv. And there was a lot of that in the film. Where when Jonathan tells about his first time, I just thought Jonathan tells about his first time, because I knew the story he was going to tell. And what I did was, the night before we were going to shoot it, I just said, Jonathan, when you go home tonight and go to bed, I want you to relive that. When all the lights are out, you're by yourself, it's dark, before you go to sleep, I want you to relive that experience, you know, moment by moment in real time, everything that happened. And so he did that, and then the next day when we came to shoot the scene, and he's telling Spermball the story, he's telling him the story for the first time, and he remembered all these details that he'd forgotten, all these details that I didn't know, and details that he had actually forgotten. So by having him relive it, he told the story to Milton. So that's not written. So what I'm saying was, I knew what I was doing and what I was going to get, but people had to trust me, because the script was only barely 50 pages, but I knew what it was.
My friend Jim Toback.
Oh, sure.
Worked like in this general fashion, which mm-hmm. is to write knowing pretty clearly in his own head what he intends to have happen. And he communicates that, but he lets the inspires the actors to
You know, I was one of, you know, it's interesting, he did that film, was it called Black and White?
Yeah, and also the follow-up one he did with, When Will I Be Loved.
I didn't see When Will I Be Loved, but I saw Black and White, which was interesting, because I actually liked the film, but kids hated that film. I mean, violently hated that film. And
In New York, we're talking about.
In New York, yeah. I went with some kids to New York. I went with maybe my daughter, my son, mm-hmm. some of their friends, And they hated that film, and I liked the film, and I figured out the reason why they hated it is because he's making white kids look goofy and stupid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they really, you know, didn't like the film, but I liked the film a lot. That was really, really right on, and a good film. But it was interesting just the reaction after the film with these kids that I was with, how much they, and maybe that's me figuring out. They didn't say that, but I figured out, I think, why they had a problem with it, because he made the white kids, you know, wiggers and goofy.
There's very few people who know how to make films, who have any kind of track record, who have a sense of how to deliver something, who have the investment, kind of a naturalistic investment into the real, the personalities and the moods and the culture of under 21s. Besides yourself, I can't think of anybody else who's really as invested as you are.
I can't even.
And as who does is, you know, you can really depend on a certain authenticity coming from your films, which is what I've always, you know, from the time of kids on, I've really responded to.
Thank you.
What direction do you see going after this is out and you've done the publicity? What's the next film? What do you?
I have a bunch of irons in the fire, but I actually have three films ready to go with producers, and the screenplays are ready to shoot, and I have producers, and they're all in three different films. So I don't know which one that I'll do first, and which one we'll find the money for first. But they'll find the money for first. One is a one I was just sent. And it's a true story. It's about marijuana and drug smuggling in the Everglades in the early 70s. And they used to drop bales into the water, and then they'd have someone on the ground go pick them up.
And that wouldn't hurt the pot?
No, they do that all the time.
Okay.
All the time. And as a matter of fact, I just got a call. I just talking to a friend of mine in New York who used to be a drug dealer like 25 years ago. And he was saying, well, that's what we used to do. That's what I did, you know. And
we're talking about dropping bales from airplanes?
Yeah, from
No.
Those are small planes. You know, they would buzz the water and drop them off, and then someone would pick them up.
I got it.
And then they did it later with cocaine, and you know, that was a big, that was what it was done back then. But anyway, so it's a film about that, which is based on a true story, which I like true stories.
Hmm.
Like Bully was a true story.
Yeah.
And then there's another film that I optioned a few years ago, the screenplay called Syrup, SYRUP, which is about the hip hop scene in Houston. And I tried to raise money to make this film a couple of years ago, but knowing that this music was going to hit big time, and nobody quite got it. But now Mike Jones and Paul Walden and the legacy of a DJ Screw and all that music is the number one music in the country now. You turn on a hip hop station, there's rotation of three tunes over and over and over again, and it's Mike Jones, it's Paul Wall.
How do you spell Paul's last name?
Wall, W-A-L-L.
Okay.
He says, I'm Paul Wall. And I had no idea it was Paul Wall, but now I know it's Paul Wall. But anyway, it's great music, and I have the funniest, the best script of all time, written by a guy named David Reeves. Just the funniest script. I read it right after he wrote it. I met him in New York about 3 years ago, and I read the screenplay, and I was just on the floor laughing so hard I optioned it. And so now it looks like we might get to make this film. So there's a second one, and then I have a third one, and then I have another one. I actually have four that are ready to go. One's called American Girl from Texas, which is about a girl, an ethnic girl growing up in Texas in the 80s. Starts out when she's in kindergarten and ends when she's 14. And it's about growing up in, you know, racist Texas, where if you're not white, if you're of any color, you know, and if you're not blonde-headed and look like the, you know, and try to look like the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, you're a bad word. It starts with an N. It's an incredible story about first generations American growing up in Texas.
the culture in general, I mean, the idea of there being all white Anglo-Saxon bastions, you know, trying to maintain that that all white American thing, that basically it's just not a reality anymore.
There's so many immigrants, and the country is going to be in, they say 30, 40 years, the majority of people in the country will be Latino.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just, you know, it's just, it's interesting when you say the bastion of white America is that, like, South Central, as you know, is part of L.A. It's a big part of L.A., but there's no white people there, zero white people. The kids in the film never have known white people except me, except teachers. They had some teachers who were white, but they've never, like, really had a friend or known anybody that was white because there are no white people out there. And if you drive out of South Central, like you take La Brea or something, and you're driving, I think it's 5-6 miles from there, and you look around the cars, there's no white people driving that way. I mean, it's really this isolated, large area of Los Angeles, and there's a lot of enclaves in L.A. like that. I mean, you know, Korean town and Chinatown and Ethiopian town and all the different little sections, but South Central is unique in that way, I think.
You know what's interesting about New York, and I've been staying the last three times I've been there, there's a screenwriter who has a place in the East Williamsburg area, Bushwick,
mm-hmm.
Bushwick Montrose on the L line, and that is basically been a Hispanic neighborhood, a middle class Hispanic neighborhood, and by and by, you know, more and more under 40s people who don't make six figures are moving in there, and mm-hmm. the apartments are the rents, the whole thing is going up big time. They're building buildings and condominiums, and the interesting thing is that these poor people who've lived here, they're being priced out
mm-hmm.
by white kids from
mm-hmm.
who can't afford to live in Manhattan. And I was just thinking, this is the merger of the cult. You do see white, but what happens is the whites push out the Hispanics out. I mean, they can't afford it eventually because of the, you know. So I don't know if there's, I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't know if there's any basis for assimilation of a college-educated culture and Hispanic, because it's not the, I don't think it's just mixing races or having, you know, people of one attitude or color or mood or mode, but it's just that there's no particular interest in lower middle-class cultures
mm-hmm.
of bookstores and cafes mm-hmm. and things that I respond
mm-hmm.
to, you know. It's all kind of
right,
food
yeah.
is shitty, you know, it's cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
I really love being over there. It's a great place where you can have breakfast for $3 every morning. It's really lovely. You know?
Where is this?
Called El Brillante on Montrose. I love going to this place.
Right,
I love.
Right, yeah.
I really got to know all these people. I like it, but it's not the kind of thing that you want. You know, I don't know what I'm saying, but I'm just saying I don't know that there's any basis for
It seems like you say, yeah, like South Central, there's no cafes.
Yeah.
There's no restaurants. There's no place to sit. There's no coffee shops.
Poor areas of Paris, you see that, though.
Right.
You know?
And every place has the plastic, you know, bulletproof screen, you know, everywhere, you know. It's like, you know, hamburger stands have it, you know. It's like there's no... You know,
this is all
and
about.
You know, just for example, of like paying after you eat isn't done.
Yeah.
I mean, kids. I mean, I would take these kids skating all the time, and on every Saturday for a year, I took them skating.
Uh-huh.
And then we would eat. We would go somewhere and eat. And if we went to and if I took them to a restaurant, they would, you know, you don't have to pay for first. I mean, it was just an experience they'd never had.
Yeah.
You know, so it's.
Are you a skater?
I was, but I started skating when I wanted to do I wanted to make my first film about the skateboarding culture, and I knew a kid who was a skater, Tobin Yelland, who was like 18 and wanted to be a photographer, and I met him at a workshop that I took a gig to do a little workshop one summer for a week. Because I wanted to meet Bill Klein, William Klein, the photographer, and I'd never met him, and he was teaching the workshop. I said, okay, I'll do it. So for a week. So anyway, so Tobin So these workshops are all like middle, you know, middle class housewives in the summer, you know, with photography. But there was this one kid there, Tobin, who was like 18, wanted to be a photographer, and he was a skater. So I ended up telling him, I said, you know, well, you should photograph every aspect of the life. Don't just photograph tricks, photograph your friends doing everything they do, you know, just photograph everything. And then after the workshop, he would send me, he was in California, in San Francisco, I was in New York, he would send me prints, and I would critique him, I'd call him and critique his work over the phone, and within a year or so, he was like a skateboard photographer, he was in all the magazines, he was a crackerjack, he really caught on and became a very good photographer very fast. So when I wanted to do a film, I said, well, I want to do something about contemporary teenagers, which I really don't know much about at all, you know, I'd done a lot of autobiography in my photography work in my books and stuff, and I said, I want to do something about, not about me, about, you know, let's see what's going on with these kids now. And I thought skateboarding culture was the most interesting, because visually it's incredible. Plus, these kids were like outlaws. All the adults hated them, you know, because they had this freedom, you know. For a little boy, they could, you know, they made their own fun. The whole city is a concrete playground. They figured all this out, and so they had this freedom that adults didn't understand or like particularly. So, and if you're going to get into this culture and photograph skateboarders, you can't run after them because they're moving all the time, so I had to learn to skate. So I learned how to skate, go fast, stay on the board, hold my Leica without falling off, and keep up with these kids. And I started skating when I was like in my 40s. I mean, it was really like stupid. Because it's really a brutal sport. You really get hurt.
And, I was going to say, it's also surfing, right? I mean,
yeah.
Don't you have to get it when you're 14, 15?
And if you try to get it when you're 45, 46 years old, forget it. You know, these kids fall and... the big thing is learning how to fall, but these kids hurt themselves, but they bounce right back because they're young.
Mm.
Me, I get hurt, it takes a year to heal. But anyway, to do this, I had to learn how to skate, so I did skate. But it's interesting, Tobin Yellen walked me into the world. I said, I want to meet skateboarders and do something with skateboarding. And he walked me in the world and said, Larry's okay. And then when I came back to New York, I went to Washington Square and I started meeting more skaters, and so over a couple of year period I got the idea for kids just from getting to know them so well that I knew they let me in this world where no adults were allowed, so I was given access. So I skated, yeah, I was a skater, and hurt myself big time, but...
Are any of the people who you cast in What's Up Rockers going to be in Park City to just see the films?
No, they're in school, and so we're not taking anybody to Park City, but I'm just going to be there for a couple of days just to introduce the film. And,
okay.
But I think that there's a couple of kids in the film that could have a career if they wanted to be actors, and it's so difficult, but there's certainly a Jonathan Velasquez is so good looking, the camera loves him.
Yeah.
He's very good in the film. And then Kiko is this little natural actor. I had no idea, man. I mean, he like saved the film. Whenever I get in trouble, he would do something.
Yeah.
He's such a good little actor. And
for the my putting this this audio interview up, is there a way to get a clip or two of dialogue from the film?
Sure.
I really like what I heard, the way it sounds. Is there a way to? Do you have a file that you send me? Possibly.
Well, they can. I can't. But we can figure this out on Monday. I mean, on Tuesday, they can send you something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should I call you about this?
You should talk to David Schultz.
Right.
And you can get him through Margo.
David Schultz through Margo.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. That's what I would really like to.
Right.
I think.
Yeah, you can call Margo. Margo can figure that out.
Hello? Hi. I'll have to call you right back. I'm sorry, I'm in the middle of an interview. All right, I think I got enough.
Oh, excellent.
Thank you very much for
taking
the time.
Thank you. It's really nice to talk to you. I wish we could talk a long time. It's really good.